think it is a really interesting time to be alive. I think it's a really, really interesting time to be alive and to be living in the United States of America. I think that we live in a time of unprecedented change in our country. I mean, we're in a time of unprecedented change. Economically, things are changing. Obviously, politically, things are changing. Socially, things are changing. But I think there are some things moving beneath the surface that are maybe even more interesting. Things related to the way that we as Americans see the world, ways that we think ideologically about what's right, what's true, what's good, what's beautiful. I think that those things are shifting and that they're changing. It's like the land is moving beneath our feet. Just to paint a picture for you, I'm going to share some numbers. If you're a numbers person, if you really, really enjoy surveys and like looking at data, you're going to love the next few minutes. If you're not that kind of person, please don't check out. Please don't disappear. I'll get through this as quickly as possible. But I want to, without judgment or without any sort of commentary, I just want to give you some numbers that I think paint a picture for the kind of changes that I think we're experiencing and have been experiencing for a while now. The Gallup organization, which is a large polling organization, they ask Americans questions about a lot of different things. For the last 16 years, since 2001, Gallup has conducted a poll to gauge Americans' attitudes on a variety of moral issues. They've asked Americans, do you think that this particular thing is morally acceptable or morally not acceptable? And what I think is really interesting is as you read these numbers, it paints a picture for the way that things have been changing over time. Let me just give you, again, without judgment, without commentary, I'm just going to give you some of the results of these polls over the last 16 years. So first of all, nowhere, I think, has our attitude as a country been changing more than as it relates to human relationships and sexuality. So in 2001, Americans were basically split on their opinion of whether or not premarital sex, sex between two adults, consenting adults outside of marriage, was morally acceptable or not acceptable. 53% of people saw it as morally acceptable. In 2016, that number had risen to 67%. So that number is moving towards a place where we believe as a country that that is more a morally acceptable thing. Another huge change, obviously, that's been taking place over that period of time is our opinion about relationships of same-sex couples. So in 2001, 40% of Americans felt like same-sex couples were morally acceptable. So that was a minority view in 2001. By 2016, last year, that number was 60%. Meanwhile, what's interesting is the acceptability of an affair has stayed relatively low. We believe that it's still wrong if you're married to have a relationship with somebody outside of your marriage. That stayed really, really low. Last year was at about 10%, but it's actually been growing in acceptability. Like 2001, that number was at 7. So there's been a little bit of movement and growth towards the acceptability of having an affair. Likewise, I think this one is really interesting because I think this is actually a trend and a movement. Polygamy remains pretty low. Acceptability for being in a relationship with multiple people or being married to multiple people is at 14%, but it was at 7% in 2001. So that's doubled in 16 years. Couple more, and hang with me if you're not data people. Hang with me just a couple more. Another big change is our attitude towards children born outside of marriage. Back in 2001, 45% of people said that that was morally acceptable for someone to have a child who wasn't married. In 2016, that number was 60%. And this isn't just beliefs or attitudes. This is actually practice. For last year was the 8th year in a row that 40% or more of every child born in America was born to an unwed mother. Now, another interesting one here, our perspective on suicide. Approval of suicide has been low. Moral approval of it being a morally acceptable thing to do has been low. It stayed around 18% for the whole time Gallup has been doing these surveys. And yet, support for doctor-assisted suicide has gone from a minority of 49% to a majority of 53%. And obviously, states like Colorado have accepted that and have turned that into law. Now, beyond these like specific issues, Gallup also asked Americans, like, hey, do you think, how do you think about the moral condition of our country? Is it good? Is it fair? Is it poor? Only 45% of people said that they believe that the moral state of America is poor. And 72% of people asked said, yeah, I think it's actually getting worse. I think morally we're getting worse. And it's not about these specific issues. They said it was a general sense that we're just not kind to one another. We're not understanding. There's just problems with basic civility and respect with people. Now, here's what I think makes this somewhat interesting is that these shifts and changes have been happening along with another shift. During the same time that Gallup has been doing these polls, another change, another massive change has been happening quietly, silently in our country. And it relates to how Americans think about their beliefs and attitudes toward God, how they think about the practice of religion. America is becoming less and less affiliated with organized religions and more pluralistic every single day. During the time that Gallup has been doing those moral questions, another trend has been taking place, and that is more and more people, when asked, what religion would you identify with? More and more people in our country have said, none. I don't affiliate with any particular religion. That number has grown to, what's interesting is that number has grown. 22% of Americans, when asked that question, what do you identify with as you think about religion? 22% of Americans say none. Now, just put that in historical context, through the 40s and 50s, that number was at 2 to 3%. Never cracked above 10% until like the 1990s. And so now all of a sudden, in the 2000s, what we're seeing is more and more people are disengaging from a regular practice of faith. And obviously, there's a lot of regional differences that our country is not one place. It's lots of different places. But Colorado is on the front edge of that trend. 30% of people in Colorado would say, yeah, I have no religious affiliation. I don't really practice or engage in any particular religion. And that's, by the way, with Colorado Springs included. So if we take them out, like man, that number's got to be a lot higher. I mean, can you imagine? Here's what I think that means for us. And here's what why I think it's important for us to talk about this. First off, if you're here today, and you are here today, at least in body, you're in a big minority. You're in a big minority for people who live in our state, for your friends and coworkers and neighbors. This is not something that most people engage in on a regular basis. But beyond that, because of the shifts that have been taking place, I don't have to get into commentary about how the Bible talks about some of those moral questions or moral issues, for you to know that there's some shifts and some changes that have been taking place where suddenly that the people who we live around, the people who we work with, the people who we spend time with, who are our friends, see the world often very differently than we do. And depending on where you grew up, depending on how old you are, depending on how long you've been a follower of Jesus, those shifts and changes, you may be feeling those, you may be feeling a lot of tension around those, because it may feel like the country that you call home doesn't really feel like the place that you grew up in. I mean, for someone like me who's a little bit older, I've been following Jesus most of my life, and I grew up in Mississippi, the most religiously active place. When asked how many people is religion very important to you, in Mississippi, 63% of people said it's very important, which means they go to church like once a week. Here, that number is like 30%. So I feel like I live in a different country since moving to Denver 8 years ago. But the question that I want to ask us and I want us to focus on is over the next 4 weeks is this. What do we do about it? So what? So what does that mean for us? For those of us who consider ourselves to be followers of Jesus, what does it mean that the culture that we live in is increasingly at odds and different from the faith that we try to practice and that we talk about when we gather together on Sundays, when we meet in homes, in D groups, and talk about what does it mean to follow the way of Jesus? What does it mean for us? What do we do when we walk out into a world, when we go to our neighborhoods, when we go to our workplaces, and increasingly the people that we spend time with outside of our community of faith see the world very differently than us? What do we do? Do we stick our heads in the sand and just pretend that nothing is happening, like that we just keep doing the things that we've been doing? Do we fire up the old culture wars again, go back to the 80s and take back America, make America great again, make it moral again by fighting against all of these things that we see as morally at odds with our beliefs? Or should we withdraw from society altogether? Should we create alternate communities? Should we go buy some land somewhere out in rural Colorado and all go live together and churn butter and like raise barns and be Amish? You know, is that what we're supposed to do? Or is there something else? Is there another way? I actually think the answer to these questions, I think insight into the way that we think about living in a culture and a society where we're at odds, or our way of seeing the world is at odds with a lot of the people we live around, I think the answer to that modern question is actually very ancient. Because this isn't the first time in history that God's people have asked these questions or wrestled with this dilemma. The Bible's full of tremendous wisdom and insight about what it looks like to live in cultures where God's people are at odds or see the world differently than those around them. And I think that the answers that we look for, the insight that we need, is found in understanding this word and this concept that we find throughout the Bible, and it's the word exile. It's the word exile. Now, this word exile, it refers to the state of living outside of your native country, often forcibly so. Often people who live as exiles have been forced out of their home, forced to live in a different place, or they've been occupied by another country or culture, and they are being forced to live within a place that's not their home. To live in exile simply means to live in a place that's not your home. And exile is actually, it's a major theme throughout all of the Bible, through the Old Testament and the New Testament. In the Old Testament, God's people, the Israelites, they were forced into literal exile, actually a number of different times. But the most significant happened in 586 BC when the nation of Israel was conquered by the nation of Babylon. And their great king, King Nebuchadnezzar, that rolled into Jerusalem. The Israelites had been resistant for some time, and finally he just squashed them. I mean, he leveled their temple, he destroyed their city, he took captives, he took people prisoner, took them back to Babylon and forced them to live in his culture. We have a lot of stories from people like Daniel, people like Esther, who were forced to live in captivity, forced to live in exile. This was a massive, massive experience of judgment and of abandonment from God by the nation of Israel. And it's a massive part of the story of the Old Testament. It left a really jagged scar on the collective memory of the Israelites. Because from their perspective, from that point forward, they were people, it was the beginning of time of exile. It was the beginning of time when they were looking to be restored back to their place of prominence. You see, God chose the nation of Israel in the Old Testament to be his representatives on earth, to be his representative to the nations, to be a testimony of who God, this one true living God, really was. And they were to be a light. They were to be a blessing to the rest of the nation. The problem is the nation of Israel was constantly failing in this mission, constantly failing in the way that God had called them to be and to live. And so eventually God removed his hand of protection. The Babylonians came in, conquered them. And from that point forward, Israel was no longer a nation. It was no longer a state. Not until 1948, when the modern state of Israel was reorganized. Because you see, over time, there were other countries that came and went. The Assyrians eventually overthrew the Babylonians, kicked them out. But they still occupied the land. They still were the dominant culture. They were the ones who made the rules. The Medes, the Persians, the Greeks, eventually the Romans during Jesus' time would roll in. And Israel would become just a backwater province of the Roman Empire. And so from that point forward, the Israelites began to live in this place of longing to be restored back to what they had. They thought about the good old days, and they thought about how wonderful it was when they were their own country. They longed for the promised Messiah, a leader, a king in the line of David who would come as a military leader, as a political leader, and who would make Israel great again, who would restore them back to their prominence and give them their land, give them their place of prominence again. They longed for that, and they looked for that. And it's why they ultimately rejected Jesus, because he could never fit their needs. They needed him to be a political leader who would fight off the Romans, who would recreate Israel. But that's not who Jesus was. See, for Jesus' followers, what they saw is that there was a much bigger plan, a bigger picture that was going on, a bigger story that God was writing. They saw his death and then his resurrection as a part of God's greater story of redemption and reconciliation for the earth. Jesus came first to conquer sin and to conquer death on the cross, but he promised that one day he would return, and one day he would establish this promised kingdom of God, a place where all of humankind could dwell with God and could experience the kind of oneness and intimacy of relationship with him that he had desired from the beginning. A place where God's kingdom would come literally, physically on this earth, and God's will would be done as it is now in heaven. This is what Jesus taught his followers to pray for, to long for, is this kingdom. But until then, Jesus' followers began to adopt this identity, this understanding of themselves as people who were living in exile. Regardless of where they lived in the world, regardless of what country they lived in, or what ethnicity that they were, what dominant culture that they were part of, they began to embrace this identity that they saw themselves as exiles, longing for this kingdom of God which was coming, which was breaking through as they gathered together in small communities and lived by the kingdom values that they had been given by Jesus. But knowing that the fullness of the kingdom would never be a reality until the king returned. In the book of Hebrews, the author writes, to try and illuminate this perspective for his readers, he's trying to give them a perspective of this identity, of what it means to be the people of God, traveling through life, longing for something more, wanting to be a part of a community and a place where God's perfect will is done, and recognizing that the nations of this earth, regardless of when or where you live, were never going to be this. In chapter 11, the famous faith chapter, where the author writes about the faith of the great, all the great patriarchs, all the great fathers and mothers of our faith. He writes and talks about how all the enormous deeds that they did and the way that they lived their life by faith day by day, year by year. And then he says this, we're going to put these verses on the screen, Hebrews 11, verses 13 through 16. Listen to what the author says about these great people of faith. He says, all of these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance, admitting that they were foreigners and strangers on earth. People who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they'd been thinking of the country that they had left, they would have had the opportunity to return. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. So the author says, hey, look, the reason that the heroes of our faith kept going was that they had this vision. Not that for something that was behind them, not for a sentimentality about a time when past when Israel was great and when they could be restored. No, they had a longing for something in the future. And that's what their faith drove them towards. They kept believing that they had not received fully that promise of a place where God's will would be done, that kingdom reality. And so they kept living forward, looking forward. And as he thinks about all the great heroes of the faith, he says, think about them. Think about the way that they live, the way that they live in expectation and in anticipation of this coming kingdom. They lived as exiles. They embraced this reality that this place, though it was the place that they lived and called home, it was not fully their home. It was never fully going to satisfy. They were never fully going to feel comfortable or at home in this place. They longed for the kingdom of God, for God's kingdom to come, his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. And the author says that the key is not to be distressed about living in exile, but to embrace it, to own that that's who we are as God's people. We are his exiles living as strangers and aliens. Listen to how he continues in the next chapter, Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1 through 3. he writes this. He says, therefore, in light of all that, in light of all these people who've gone before us and given us this pattern, this picture of living by faith, therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Therefore, in light of all the people who've gone before us, who've lived by faith in expectation and in hope for the kind of kingdom that we long for when Jesus returns, in light of all of them, let's do these three things, the author says. Let us first of all, throw off the sin that entangles us. He says we have to understand that it is easy to be entangled in the dominant culture that we live in. When we live in a place whose values are not kingdom values, it is very often easy to become entwined. And he says, don't do that. Live differently. Your lives are to be marked by different values, not by the values of the culture that you live in, not by American values or any other kind of values for the place that you live. Your values are to be marked by kingdom values. You're to live differently. Secondly, run with perseverance. This is not going to be an easy journey. Run with perseverance the race that is marked out for us. Each one of us has a different story. Each one of us has been born into a different story in a different place. We live different lives. What it looks like to live this out, this faithfulness out, is going to look different for each one of us, he says. But we're to live differently in the places that God's called us, the places that God's placed us. And how do we do that? We stay focused. We stay focused not on what's happening around us, we stay focused on Jesus. He is the author, the pioneer, the perfecter of our faith, says the author of Hebrews. We learn from him how to be like him. As we study his life, as we learn together in community, by the power of his presence through the Holy Spirit, we learn what it means to be a kingdom-oriented people living in a place that is very different, that operates by very different values, to be people of the kingdom of God in this place. This is what it looks like for us to embrace our identity as exiles and to live as kingdom people, even in a culture that is at odds or sometimes in opposition to the things that we believe. Now, here's why I think that this is so important for us specifically today, sitting here, 21st century America. Here's why I think this is so important for us. Don't miss this. I think that we are so incredibly fortunate to live where we live. I've traveled to a lot of different places around the world. I've seen a lot of different countries. I've experienced a lot of different cultures. And I can honestly say there is nowhere else on planet Earth that I would rather live than America. I absolutely love the country that I was born to. I love this place that I call home. For all of our problems, for all of our faults, for all of our shortcomings, I still think that this is an amazing place to live. And part of the reason that I think that this is such an amazing country is because we're built on this fundamental assumption that everyone should be free to pursue God or not pursue God the way that they desire, the way that they see fit. We're free to express ourselves in different religious practices. We're free to be able to pursue God in the way, or not pursue God in the way that we want. And that value has allowed the freedom for people to explore different faiths. It's allowed for lots of different faiths to flourish, including ours, including Christianity, which is a really, really good thing. But contrary to the mythology that has developed over time, the United States is not and has never been a Christian nation. Christian is not an adjective, it's a noun. A Christian is a person who follows the way of Jesus. There's no such thing as Christian nations. While it is true that our faith flourished because of the people who came here, because of the forefathers of our country who created this environment for religion to flourish, our faith has flourished here more than any other. And it's become by far the religious affiliation that most people still identify with, even at a time when people are increasingly disengaging from any sort of identification to faith. The majority of Americans still think of themselves or have this sort of identity as Christians. But here's the problem. Over time, it becomes very easy to assume that American values are the same thing as Christian values, the same thing as kingdom values, even when there begins to be a separation or a difference in those things. We become blind. We assume that what it means to be an American is to be a Christian, and what it means to be a Christian is to be an American. And those two things could not be further from the truth. We are still exiles. We're still foreigners. This is not fully our home. This is not a place that fully affirms and agrees with and goes along with the things that we see, the things that we value, the kingdom values that Jesus has given us. And when we do that, when we make that mistake, when we assume that what it means to be Christian is it means to be an American, is the same thing as it means to be an American, I think the authors of Hebrews would say that's when you begin to get entangled into the sin that is inherent in the dominant culture in which you live. Because every culture, every single nation in some way or another has sin that is intricately intertwined into it, and we don't even begin to see it. And I'm not even talking about these individual personal moral issues that Gallup's asking about. Let's set those aside for just a second. Let's not beat the drums that gets beaten in the media all the time by Christians. Let me just ask about some deeper systemic American values that I think are anti-kingdom that I don't even think we see. Let me ask you about this. How much are we aware of and even cognizant of how much violence is just a natural part of the American value system, both individually, personally, and as a nation? Are we bothered? Do we even see this anymore? Do we even recognize how much it's glorified in popular culture and entertainment and movies and video games and on the news? We love to win as Americans. We love to dominate other people. And as people who are called to love our enemies, to pray for the people who persecute us, does that not bother us at all that that's such a dominant value? What about greed? What about greed? Do we see, are we even aware of how much greed pervades and moves forward everything that we do as an American system? Do we even see that? I mean, we were all disturbed when we were personally impacted in 2008, when suddenly the greed of the system was revealed and we began to see how banks and institutions at their very core were driven by this kind of greed to just accumulate and amass more, even if it meant taking unnecessary risks with other people's money. And yet here we are, you know, 9 years later. Are things really that different? Is our amount of national or personal debt going down at all? Or are we just still driven by the American dream to consume more and have more and get more? Does that even bother us as kingdom people? Do we see how much our consumerism impacts the world around us? Are we even aware of how our consumption of resources grossly outstrips the size that we are as a country, how much more we use than we are as a percentage of the world's population? Are we even aware of how our desire for low-cost goods actually marginalizes and manipulates other people in other places and other countries in ways that we don't even see when we go buy the cheap goods off? Are we even bothered by that? Are we disturbed by it? Are we concerned at all about these things? Is there anything about our lifestyle or our choices as people who follow the way of Jesus that people would look at and say differently? Or have we just blended in to our dominant American culture and become entangled in the systems of brokenness and sin that we don't even see every day? To be an exile is to recognize that we live with different values. We live with kingdom values. Our life is not driven by a picture of the American dream. It's to be driven by a vision of the kingdom, by a vision of a place where God's will is done perfectly in this place under Jesus' rule, not the Democrats or the Republicans. We will never fix the inherent brokenness. So what are we to do? How are we to live as Americans in this place? Well, that's what I want to talk about over the next 3 weeks. I want to talk about what it means really practically to embrace our identity as exiles and begin to live as kingdom people in a dominant culture that maybe is at odds, maybe even at times in opposition to the things that we believe.